Okay, so it's the last week. It's do or die. I either teach you cosmology or fail to teach you cosmology. I aim to teach you cosmology. So basically the plan for this week, the first two lectures are going to be, you know, sort of about the basic techniques and results of particle cosmology. So dark matter and baryogenesis. It's the interaction between sort of particle phenomenology and cosmology. So if you want to do the modern version of what Gamow did, you know, you have some new model for particle physics that has some new particles in it. You want to know, does it explain the dark matter, what dark matter is? Does it explain where the matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe came from? Or does it explain some other thing? Or does it predict something crazy that's completely at odds with observations? So the first two lectures of this week will be basically it's actually very simple to go through once you get used to it, those calculations, back of the envelope estimates of those types of questions. There's a certain menu of techniques that we'll go through by doing just the sort of three most important problems of that sort relating to dark matter, and then the two most important suggestions that have been made regarding baryogenesis. That's sort of Monday, Tuesday. And then the final 3 days, I'm going to, okay, we've met inflation a little bit, but basically I want to introduce it a bit more formally. What are the basic puzzles it solves? And then, from the modern perspective, the most important thing that it does, and something that you shouldn't get out of the class without seeing, is that it predicts the primordial. It gives an explanation for where the primordial spectrum of fluctuations came from, the spectrum of tiny fluctuations in the early universe that grew into the galaxies and you and me of today. The first classic calculation, you know, so we don't have a full theory of quantum gravity, but there are sort of two classic calculations that are partway there. Those have to do with quantum field theory and curved space-time, where you think you do know how to perform the calculation. And roughly speaking, that means the background is a classical gravitational field, a classical metric, but then you have quantum matter fields living on that metric. And so the first great calculation along those lines was the Hawking evaporation calculation, where Hawking used those techniques to show that a black hole has a temperature and that it radiates with a thermal spectrum. So most people believe that calculation is great, but of course we've never observed any evidence of a black hole evaporating. Unfortunately, nature doesn't seem to have provided us with observably evaporating black holes. But the other calculation is the calculation of the primordial spectrum of perturbations due to inflation. So the statement is, heuristically, that the universe starts, the field, some quantum field in the universe starts in its vacuum state, the so-called inflaton field, and then the universe exponentially expands, and that exponential expansion generates from the vacuum a spectrum of quantum fluctuations in that field, which, for the simplest models, matches exceptionally well the observed fluctuations that you observe, for example, in the statistics of clustering of galaxies today or in the statistics of fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So I just wanted to give you a non-hand-waving explanation of that point. Somehow that's actually quite a simple thing to derive. And usually you just kind of hear people say things like quantum fluctuations being created out of the vacuum. And I don't know. So somehow the most important thing to get across is that is a very concrete, simple thing to actually see on the blackboard. So the final 3 days will be about that. And then before I get going today with the three standard dark matter calculations, sort of the predictions of the three standard WIMP models of dark matter, I just wanted to start by giving another sort of overview of what the universe looks like. So gradually, as things have been going along, you know, in cosmology, there is no sort of precisely linear route to just introducing what the picture of the universe looks like. So we just have to step back for every once in a while and take a new look. So what is the current standard model of the universe? What is the current standard model of cosmology, which explains the data very well? So in brief, it is the following. So we said that the Friedmann equation looks like this. So according to the current standard model, rho, the energy density in the universe, has several components. It has a radiation density, which today has value rho sub radiation comma zero, where the comma zero will always be what I use to indicate today from now on. And that scales like radiation. That part of the energy density scales like radiation, meaning to the minus fourth power. Remember that the scaling of these things goes like a to the minus 3, 1 plus w. And we had understood previously that w equals 1/3 for radiation, so this becomes minus 4. So there's one piece like that. And there's another piece that is the matter density today. And that part scales as a to the minus 3. To our horror, there is another piece, which is the cosmological constant, which scales, which doesn't scale with a, which scales as a to the zeroth power. Okay, and the statement is that the state of the universe today is such that, so if you put a equals a naught, so all of these factors go to unity, that today, first of all, this guy is negligible. And if it's negligible today, then according to this model, it's always negligible. Because in the future, this term will be negligible relative to this term, because this term drops more quickly than this term to the future. This term drops as a to the minus 2. This term doesn't drop at all. So this term will dominate in the future. Whereas in the past, this term was dominated by these two terms, since in the past, this one goes up as a squared, but these two terms go up even faster as a to the minus 3 and a to the minus 4. So this term is negligible today, and so if this standard picture is correct, if this is really what the energy content of the universe looks like, this thing was, as far as we can tell, always negligible. We'll just forget about it for the rest of the course. And then these guys, well, today, this term appears, you know, if you you have these free parameters in this model, and you have to, and now you go out, and the statement is that for a huge amount of data, you can, by appropriately adjusting these free parameters, the present radiation density, the present matter density, the present cosmological constant density, you can fit that, you can fit a very large amount of data. And to do that, you find that this guy has to be set 0.7 times the critical density, so 70% of the current universe. So the statement that this term is negligible means that the total rho is equal to the present critical density, and it's always equal to the critical density. Remember, that was the definition of the critical density, is the density that at any given moment was such that this term alone on the right-hand side equaled the left-hand side without any need for this term. So when k equals 0, rho is equal to the critical density. So the universe today is equal. It has a total energy density equal to the critical density, of which 70% is this dark energy bit, and that will only get bigger as time goes on. So in the near future, that will be 90% and then 99%, and right, because this term is the one that's dropping off least quickly. So according to observations, if this model turns out to be correct, this term is just coming to dominate today. It's just becoming comparable to the critical density. And in the future, it will just become equal to the critical density and will dominate all these other terms. The matter density accounts for the other 30%. And the radiation density accounts for a negligibly small fraction. It's something like 10 to the minus 4 of the critical density. So in more detail, what we mean by this radiation density is it's this leftover CMB radiation. Okay, so a leftover bath of photons that are just streaming through the universe as if they had a temperature of 3 Kelvin. And then there's also, it turns out, there's also another similar bath, it turns out. I mean, this is kind of a detail. I won't get into it. It's not the most important thing to know about cosmology. But so the other bit of this is there is a similar bath of neutrinos streaming through the universe, also decoupled at even earlier times, that decoupled around the time of, just like the CMB decoupled when hydrogen, when electrons and protons combined into hydrogen, the neutrinos decoupled and just went streaming off through the universe at about the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So with each of those two events that Gamow understood, around those times there was a bath of nearly massless particles that went streaming off through the universe. And so those are what we mean by the radiation density today, unless maybe the neutrinos have enough mass that they're not quite relativistic anymore, which is possible. But anyway, these are all details. So today this is a negligible fraction of the energy density of the universe. Meanwhile, the matter density, yeah.
Do we know how much neutrinos is out there? Like, have we got it?
So according to the standard picture of the early universe, which we know does a good job of, so if you want to predict how many neutrinos are in this bath, their number density, that we think we can predict very accurately, because the decoupling happens at relatively low temperatures, 1 MeV. So in other words, we think we understand the standard model of particle physics up to 1 TeV, a factor of a million higher in energy than this. Whereas these neutrinos decouple at about the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which is at this much lower energy. So the fact that we think we understand those energies, coupled with the fact that at those energies we predict the light element abundances and get them right, and so that's sort of a pat on the back that we really are, that we really do know what we're doing back then. Under those circumstances, you can predict the number density of neutrinos very well. Now, because the neutrino mass is not known yet, the neutrino masses are still, they're currently being constrained, and some of the differences between the different neutrino masses, there are three different species of neutrino that have been detected, and some of the differences have been measured, but their overall masses, none of the individual masses has had its absolute value measured yet. So we don't know the energy density well, but we know the number density well. If everything is right, if we really do perfectly understand physics at 1 MeV, and as I said, there is one glaring problem with Big Bang nucleosynthesis, possibly. There is this lithium 7 abundance that the prediction differs from the observation, so who knows? Maybe we don't understand things as well as we thought we did, but according to the standard picture, the number density of neutrinos is very well predicted. Unfortunately, it's so dilute and they're so weakly interacting that we'll probably never detect directly this neutrino background today. Like, you can't detect it in a detector on Earth, probably. Yeah.
So what temperature can be associated to today's universe?
So the universe is no longer in thermal equilibrium. So it's not really right to think about a temperature of the universe today. But there are these two relics of the period of thermal equilibrium in the early universe. And they both have redshifted in such a way that, for the photons, because they're massless, they've redshifted in such a way that their distribution still looks like a thermal bath, looks like they're still in thermal equilibrium. And the neutrinos, if they were massless, would be the same way. They're not quite massless, so that's not quite true. But for the CMB, that temperature is 3 degrees Kelvin or something like that, which And for the neutrinos, for a reason that's that I'm not going to get into, it's just slightly different than that. But it's a few Kelvin still. Meanwhile, the matter density breaks into two parts. Of this 30%, 25% appears to be dark matter, and the other 5% or 4% appears to be ordinary matter, elements in the periodic table, so-called baryons in cosmology lingo. Okay, so that's the current state of the universe. And so now, I said when we follow it forward in time, it's very simple. Everything just dilutes, and eventually things become very boring. You get dominated. You enter a universe that just is dominated by a cosmological constant and approaches the maximally symmetric De Sitter metric to the future. So what happens in the past? So in the past, if we look a little bit to the past, this term is the most important one because it's scaling. It's increasing to the past, whereas this one is staying constant. So if we look a few factors of A smaller, when the universe was a few times smaller, this guy was the dominant thing in the universe. But then if we look even further back, there's a period where this term catches up and becomes the dominant one. So if I make a plot of the energy density of these various components, the log of the energy density versus the log of A. So this goes as a to the 0, so it's like a straight line of slope 0. This guy goes as a to the minus 3, so it's a slope of it has a slope of minus 3. Okay, so today, let's say this is today. The matter density, so this is the dark energy density. This is the matter density, including both the baryons and the dark matter. And So if we look back a little bit, it comes to dominate. But then somewhere very far down here, this is only suppressed by about a factor of 2 today. But then suppressed by a factor of 10 to the minus 5 is the radiation density, which is somewhere very far down today, but it's growing even faster. And so at some sufficiently early time, it's the dominant thing. Okay. So this is today. This is so-called matter radiation equality. So A sub equality, the scale factor at matter radiation equality. So that was when the universe was a factor of a few thousand smaller than it is today. So this is somewhere between one. This is about a few thousand smaller than it was today. Big Bang nucleosynthesis happened deep in the radiation-dominated era, when the universe was about a million times smaller than it was today. So when radiation was dominating over matter and dark energy, whereas the cosmic microwave background, that happened when the universe was 1,000 times smaller than it is today, so just slightly after matter-radiation equality. Okay, when matter was dominating, but not by very much over radiation. Okay. So that's the homogeneous picture of how the universe evolved. And then we said that for various reasons, it is postulated that instead of going all the way back to the Big Bang like this, with radiation just becoming more and more dominant, there was some even earlier epoch prior to Big Bang nucleosynthesis when the radiation all got converted into an approximately constant energy density, the inflation, and this is the inflationary epoch. Okay? So the inflation epoch, in which the universe is dominated by a constant energy density, is very much analogous, but at much higher energies, to the dark energy epoch. So in both the dark energy epoch and in the inflation epoch, the universe is dominated by a constant energy density, which makes the scale factor accelerate. we showed in an earlier lecture that for the energy density to be constant, you have this continuity equation for each component. So for the energy density to be constant, this side has to vanish for rho dot to be 0. So P is equal to minus rho. So in other words, W is equal to minus 1. And we showed that when W was less than minus 1/3, which this is, that's the if the universe is dominated by a component with W less than 1/3, that's the condition for A double dot to be greater than 0. So A double dot is greater than 0 here, and it's greater than 0 over here. The universe is accelerating at the beginning and the end, according to this standard picture. And then in the middle, it went through a long period of here and here where it was decelerating. Okay. No, I do actually. But except you usually would say it in the time reversed way. So we'll see this in more detail. But you would usually say in the time reversed way there is some, according to the simplest picture of what inflation is. So really we don't know the microphysical explanation of what inflation is. And I should emphasize we don't know that inflation took place. Although it is the leading explanation for these various puzzles and the origin of the primordial fluctuations. But we'll talk about that. So the basic picture, the simplest picture is that there is some nearly homogeneous scalar field which is carrying all of the energy density in the universe and causing the universe, its energy density is nearly unchanging with time, so you have this evolution. And then at the end of inflation, it dumps its energy into radiation. So it basically is its energy, that scalar field converts its energy into radiation. Okay, so that's the homogeneous picture of the universe. First, you have a period of inflation. It dumps its energy into mostly radiation and some tiny tidbit of matter, or alternatively, this radiation is initially relativistic particles, but then as they cool off enough, some of them the temperature begins to drop below their mass, and so some of them begin to act like matter instead of radiation. Then there's a period of radiation domination during which Big Bang nucleosynthesis happens. Eventually, non-relativistic matter comes to dominate over relativistic matter. Shortly after that, the cosmic microwave background begins to stream through the universe. And then shortly before today, another weird component comes to dominate over that. And this is the sad place that we live in today, where we have all of these ridiculous components. We don't know what they're about. Okay, and then the one final thing is that this whole picture so far is homogeneous, right? I've been describing how the universe and its constituents evolve if everything is uniform, as if everything was a uniform, perfectly uniform soup that only varied in time, didn't vary in space. In fact, the actual situation is that in the radiation-dominated era, that is a very good approximation. So the universe is exceptionally uniform. It is a uniform soup that is almost identical from one point in space to the next, but is only varying in time. But the density is not perfectly uniform. So the density varies from one position to another at a given time in the early universe. It's a homogeneous part that only depends on time, but then plus a little perturbation that does depend on space. And this perturbation is only 10 to the minus 5 of this background part. So the perturbation, up to an accuracy of one part in 100,000, the universe is perfectly homogeneous at early times. But you can detect and measure in detail the statistical properties of these small 10 to the minus 5 perturbations about that background. And that is one of the essential things that you want to explain and that inflation is a purported explanation for. And then, so what happens then is that pretty much those fluctuations don't grow. They remain of order 10 to the minus 5. until you get to the radiation-dominated epoch. It turns out that during the radiation, until you get to the matter-dominated epoch. So throughout the so the idea is somehow inflation produced these. We'll get to this. We'll get to how that happens later in the week. But then, roughly speaking, those perturbations remain small. They don't grow much throughout the radiation-dominated era. But then suddenly you get to the matter-dominated era, and they are free to grow. And so, if at early times the density, you know, as a function of space, is it's large with tiny fluctuations, tiny random fluctuations. When you get to the matter-dominated era, what begins to happen is that the regions that have slightly higher density have slightly stronger gravity, and so they begin to suck matter out of the neighboring regions which have slightly lower density and so slightly weaker gravity. And so suddenly when you begin to get to the matter-dominated era, what happens is that the valleys here get lower. They're getting their matter sucked out of them. And the peaks get higher, relatively speaking. They're getting matter is getting sucked into them by gravity. Okay, and so these peaks begin to grow in amplitude with time as you get into the matter era, until they get so big, until some of them get so big that they're no longer little, they can no longer be treated as just little perturbations about the background. They begin to become significant gravitationally bound objects. So when these things become of order one, when these fluctuations are no longer little perturbations about the background, but have grown so that their amplitude is comparable to the background density, and meanwhile these guys have grown so that their depth is comparable to the average density, then you know these things, these peaks collapse into, these things become what you today call galaxies or clusters of galaxies or stars, and these things become voids that are observed today to be essentially free of matter and galaxies. So we now have enough background that at this basic level, you know, this is the picture of the universe. This is the idea, with some additional caveats that it just has a few free numbers. It has today's dark energy density, today's dark matter density, today's baryon density, today's radiation density, and then there's a couple more numbers that characterize the statistical amplitude of this spectrum and how it varies as a function of wavelength, how the typical amplitude varies as a function of wavelength. And so those roughly six, depending on how you count, those six or seven numbers, the claim is that within the context of this basic picture, those six or seven numbers now successfully fit and have continued to fit for like 10 years to our great frustration, a huge amount of data, without any clear discrepancies that would give us more hints about what some of the weirder numbers in here are about. So what is the dark energy density? What is the matter density? What is the dark matter density? What is the dark energy physically? What is the dark matter physically? It's hard to know when all you have is a measurement of their overall density today. So that basic picture, this rough thing that I've sketched, that could be like the most important thing to try to remember after the course. That basic picture of how the universe, what the current model is, and how it evolves. So, are there any questions about that, or was that clear? Yeah.
So what could be the source of dark energy?
I'll get to that in more detail. And I was gonna when I introduced scalar fields to do inflation, I was going to also talk a little bit about dark energy. Okay. So if that's cool, then I will move on to dark matter. Okay. So let me just say a couple things. Previously there were these lecture four notes. the notes have been updated a little bit. That's what I. That's I. So lecture four used to be sort of various things about thermodynamics in an expanding universe, and then also dark matter. Also CMB and BBN. And so that's now been split into slightly improved versions that are. So the thermodynamics is lecture four, and CMB and BBN is lecture five, and then then lecture six is this. The lecture six notes have also been updated in case you haven't seen that yet. So these are the dark matter notes now, and the problem set has been updated, but just in terms of wording, none of the problems have been changed. It's just more of I worried that over the weekend that the problems were not sufficiently clear, and so I ended up putting a clearer outline of how to do the problems in the lecture six notes, just so you spend more time just making sure you understand it and not trying to figure out what I was saying. So, okay. So with that said, let's get right to it. So. What about this guy? This is gonna. I mean, this could. For all we know, this is the thing that has been missing to take these lectures to the next level. So last time I tried to just give you a very much too brief explanation of what the observational motivations for dark matter were. The main thing that I wanted to get across was just that. So dark matter and dark energy, you tell people that those two things together account those two, that 95% of the universe is today is basically these two fudge factors that you don't know what they are. 70% is this fudge factor and another 25% is this fudge factor. The main thing that I wanted to get across, I don't have time to go into detail, is that, okay, so increasingly there is a lot of evidence that you have to include both of these fudge factors in this model to get things to work, but the evidence for the dark matter fudge factor, you know, it comes from so many different places and from such a range of different scales, including relatively small astrophysical scales all the way out to gigantic cosmological scales comparable to the size of the universe that you can look at today, that actually one way to say it is you don't just know that you need this fudge factor, you know a lot of properties of the dark matter that the dark matter has to have, and I'll explain this a little more today. But so it's much harder to get around a basic picture of dark matter in which it accounts for about 25% of the matter and is, as I'll explain, cold and just acts like a highly ultra non-relativistic gas of weakly interacting particles. This guy, you know, the observations that are able to detect dark energy all have to do with measuring things on scales that are comparable to the size of the observable universe today. So it's much more likely that you could find a way that the answer to this is, for example, maybe general relativity is not right. You know, maybe general relativity is not the correct theory of gravity when you get out to cosmological scales. You know, we've tested it very well in the solar system, and increasingly we've tested it very well in cosmological on astrophysical, and you know, the scales of clusters and galaxies. If you include allow yourself to include dark matter, it is much more conceivable at the moment that this guy could turn out to be re-explained by something completely other. For example, it's not a weird new component of the energy, but instead it's a weird modification of our theory of gravity. that is at the moment more likely for this than for this because this guy is measured in such a wider variety of ways. And so that meshes with the fact that there are a number of theoretical, plausible theoretical explanations from just ordinary particle physics for what particles could be accounting for this, whereas there are really no plausible theoretical explanations for what this is. So anyway. And then I was explaining that, so if we, so from now on, for these lectures, we're going to take the point of view that the dark matter, that there is dark matter in the universe that accounts for about 25% of the matter today, 25% of the energy density today. And the question is, what can you say about what it is? What are the candidates? Which ones can you rule in? Which ones can you rule out? So the first thing we did was differentiate between WIMPs and MACHOs, where by WIMPs I just mean fundamental particles that are massive and interact sufficiently weakly that we haven't detected them so far directly. We've only detected their gravitational influence on other things. Versus MACHOs, by which I mean macroscopic objects like black holes or something. And I was explaining that, first of all, it's in light of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, it's hard to make this explanation work. And furthermore, although observationally you haven't been able to directly rule out all possible macho masses, that at every macho, there are ways to look to rule out a very large range of macho masses. And so all the evidence that we have tends to disfavor, although not completely rule out this possibility. So we're not going to consider this guy anymore. And so then, if it's WIMPs, if it's fundamental particles, I was saying there's sort of, you can again divide this into three, into two categories. WIMPs that are sufficiently strongly interacting that in the very early universe they were once in thermal equilibrium. So thermal relics. And then those that are so weakly interacting or for some other reason were never in thermal equilibrium. So non-thermal relics. And then the thermal relics, so these are guys that were originally in thermal equilibrium and then at some point they froze out. They decoupled from the thermal bath. And the question is, did they decouple when they were relativistic? So those are called hot thermal WIMPs. So in other words, they decoupled when the freeze-out temperature was much bigger than their mass, or cold thermal relics. So the freeze-out temperature was much less than their mass. They were already non-relativistic when they froze out. And the main thing that I want to explain is just to quickly show how a quick estimate shows that these guys, aren't going to work. These guys, meanwhile, work perfectly. And furthermore, there is this so-called WIMP miracle that even suggests it's our, we have a lot of evidence about what dark matter is not, what properties it cannot have. The WIMP miracle is one of our very few bits of evidence that something could be on the right, that is sort of a cosmological bit of evidence that fits together to suggest that a certain explanation might be on the right track. And then the non-thermal WIMPs, again, the prime candidate is this particle called the axion, but more generally, I'll just give a quick calculation to show how the properties of these guys are different. These guys are not ruled out the way the hot thermal WIMPs are ruled out, but nor is there any particularly striking cosmological evidence that they are the right thing. Although there are candidates like the axion that are motivated by particle physics considerations. Okay, so I was going to start by explaining the basic constraint on hot thermal WIMPs and why they die. So they're the easiest ones to calculate. But so in order to calculate them, I was sort of hoping to avoid this. I mean, I wanted to keep these, you know, somehow. Yeah. The idea is to not introduce technicalities that are just going to take your attention away from the essential stuff. But okay, I am going to introduce one such tech. I decided in retrospect that I should introduce one thing, which is the formula for the entropy density, because if you're ever going to go try to compare your calculations to, it is a standard thing that enters into these calculations in cosmology textbooks, and so if you're going to go try to compare the notes to cosmology textbooks or something like that, it'll be good. So let me just say it this way. So the first law of thermodynamics is this. So if you have a piston and it has some temperature and some entropy and pressure and volume, and you want to know how much work it does and how much total internal energy it has and how it's separated between heat that you've added or taken from the piston and work that the piston has done when it expands or contracts. This is conservation of energy as expressed in thermodynamics. So now E, let's write that as energy density times volume. And entropy, let's write that as entropy density times volume. And then, okay, so where am I going with this? There was a key point where Maita, in an earlier lecture, I had not given any. So where am I going with this? I just want to ultimately explain that the entropy density, we derived this formula for the energy density of a relativistic species. We said that it was pi squared over 30 times temperature to the fourth. Times an extra factor of 7/8 if it's a fermion. Okay, and now I want to show that the entropy density for a relativistic species is just 4/3 times that. Okay, including the 7/8 for fermions versus no 7/8 for bosons. Divided by T. So in other words, 4/3 times this divided by T is 2 pi squared over 45 t cubed, and then with an extra factor of 7/8 if you're talking about the contribution from fermions. Okay, so I was just going to derive that as follows. Remember, this was the expression for a relativistic species and a non-degenerate species. So this was the situation in which you could neglect both the mass and the chemical potential of the particle relative to the temperature. So in that regime, in the regime where the chemical potentials are negligible, the pressure and the entropy density and the energy density, all of these intrinsic quantities that don't change all of these local densities, local quantities, only depend on the temperature. So now if we expand out this differential, that means that it becomes rho dV plus V d rho d temperature times dT equals T S dV, expanding out this term, plus T V dS dT times dT minus P dV. Okay, so I've just expanded it out so that every term is either a coefficient times a dV or a coefficient times a d temperature. And those two terms, you can convince yourself, have to separately cancel in this equation. Because, for example, I can The equation has to be true if I keep the volume fixed and only vary the temperature of the system. And so in particular, if you collect the dT terms here, so there's a dT term, no. Sorry, if you collect the dV terms here, there's one here, a TS term here, and a minus P. So the upshot is that the entropy is given by rho plus P over T. And for a relativistic species, we said P is just one-third rho. So this whole thing is four-thirds rho over T, which is the thing that I wanted to show here. Okay? So for a given species, is that clear? So for a given species, for a given relativistic non-degenerate species, its entropy is given by this thing. And so if you have if the universe has a bunch of relativistic species that are all in thermal equilibrium with one another, the total entropy, the key formula that we need, is that there's a contribution coming from each species, and again, with a 1 coming from each bosonic species and a 7/8 coming from each fermionic species. So there's a total effective number of species times 2 pi squared over 45 t cubed, where this total effective number of species, Gs, is the sum over all bosonic species plus 7/8 times the sum over all fermionic species. Okay, so, and now the only point here is that the reason that you introduce this quantity is as the universe evolves, the quantity that is conserved best, the best quantity with which to compare other things, assuming, so it turns out that, so you know that if you adiabatically expand a piston, that in the absence of strongly entropy-generating processes, for example, a strong first-order phase transition can be a strong entropy-generating process. The end of inflation is an extremely strongly entropy-generating process. Or there's various other things that can generate entropy. But for the scenarios that we're going to consider, the idea is going to be that they are the simplest scenarios in which you don't have any events like that occurring between the moment of freeze-out and the present day. So in such scenarios, between the moment of freeze-out and the present day, the entropy is conserved. The entropy turns out to always be dominated by relativistic species. And so the essential point that the essential point that I wanted to make is that like any density corresponding to a conserved quantity, if entropy is conserved, the entropy density will go as a to the minus 3. And so the argument, again and again, you use the following basic argument when you're trying to compare some particle physics idea to what you know about cosmology. You say, okay, at some moment, particle chi freezes out, and at that moment, it has number density n sub chi. It freezes out, it decouples from the thermal bath. After that moment, its number density, its total number is conserved. Chi particles are no longer created or destroyed. So their number density goes as a to the minus 3. But the entropy density of the thermal bath itself also goes like a to the minus 3 from that moment until today. And so the ratio n sub chi over s is conserved. And so in particular, you just always use the following argument, I can't stress, comes up again and again, which is that given your model, you can calculate what the number density was at freeze-out, and you can calculate what the entropy density of the thermal bath was right after freeze-out. And that has to be equal to the number density of chi particles today divided by the entropy density today. Now, the entropy density today, this is also a known, this is also the entropy density of relativistic particles, namely the total entropy in the cosmic microwave background plus that bath of relic neutrinos that I was talking about. That's a known quantity also. So from this equation, the only thing you don't know how to calculate a priori is the number density of chi particles today. And so this equation lets you solve for the number density of chi particles today, which is the thing that you then end up comparing against observations. Okay? So that's a key point. I'm just going to use that argument now again and again for three different types of dark matter model and show how it gives three different predictions. Crap. What do you suggest? Yeah, go over here. Good idea. So the first and simplest model is a hot thermal relic. So that means there's some particle chi which freezes out when it is still relativistic. So at the moment that it freezes out, its number density is given by the relativistic formula. It's the number of spin states that the particle has. For each degree of freedom, there's a contribution to the number density. And times this formula that we derived, zeta of 3 over pi squared times the temperature it frees out, cubed. The entropy density of the rest of the thermal bath right after freeze out, S sub f, is given by that formula that we just derived. It's the total number of effective species in the thermal bath at the moment of freeze out. Total number of relative, by the way, sorry. The idea is that this sum is to be performed, if you're calculating the total number of effective degrees of freedom contributing to the energy density, the statement is always that relativistic degrees of freedom dominate the contribution to the energy density. And so this sum is only to be performed over relativistic degrees of freedom. So as the universe cools down and the temperature drops below the masses of various particles, and they become more and more particles become non-relativistic as the universe cools down, this number gradually drops. Okay, so in the early universe, if you count up all the, you know, when the temperature was above 1 TeV, and you count up all the relativistic degrees of freedom in the standard model, you know, this is of order 100, whereas if you ask about it instead today, it's of order 3. Okay? But the details are not going to matter at all for this sort of calculation. I'm just adding this stuff again. Please do not get hung up about this GS business. I'm just trying to say a few words about it so you're not bewildered when you try to look in a cosmology textbook after this course. Then the entropy density today is the same thing, but with the effective number of degrees of freedom today, which is, this is, again, I'm not going to explain this point. It turns out that's 3.91 today. It's not important. It's just some number of order one. Okay. So the statement is that the ratio of this to this, in which you notice that the TF drops out. So we don't know what the freeze-out temperature is. We haven't calculated that yet. But it turns out we don't need to know it because it just divides out of that ratio. That, you know, I'm applying this formula now. I'm taking the ratio of those first two formulae on this side. I'm plugging in the third formula in the denominator here. And then I just rearrange to get an expression for n sub chi at 0. And this is something that is one of the problems that you're supposed to go through on the homework. So suffice it to say that when you just collect, so you solve, you use that equation to solve for, this was n sub chi at freeze out, sorry. And the one unknown in that conservation equation is n sub chi today. Okay, so you solve for that. You get some expression for that. But then if the chi is, under the assumption that the chi is, the idea was to have it be a dark matter particle. So under the assumption that it is non-relativistic today, even though it was relativistic when it froze out, its energy density today is just its mass times its number density today. And then you can divide that by the critical density today, which is, we said the critical density is always 3h squared over 8 pi g, and so the critical density today is 3 times h today squared over 8 pi g. So this can be rewritten. G Newton again is 1 over m Planck squared. So this is 3 h naught squared m Planck squared over 8 pi. So fine. So now we have an expression for the energy density in chi today, the critical density today, and the observed fact is that the ratio of those two things, if you want it to be a dark matter particle, the ratio of those two things should be about 25%, should be about a quarter. Okay, so on the problem set, it's just a matter of going through the algebra here, which is just, the point of it is not to make you go through algebra, which is, you'll find it's incredibly simple algebra. The point is just to make sure you think about each step and make sure you understand why physically is each step true. So you get some expression, and the bottom line with that expression is that, so the expression you get is the number of degrees of freedom of the chi particle, the total number of relativistic degrees of freedom at freeze out, and then 8 times 10 to the minus 2, H100 squared, I'll explain what that is in a second, M chi over an EV. Before I say, what the key point about this expression is, let me just tell you. So this is depending on what your chi particle is, maybe it's a spin 1/2 particle, so G sub chi is 2 because there's 2 possible spin states, and GS sub F, okay, that's some number. Maybe it's depending on when it froze out, maybe that number was 100 or maybe it was 10. It's not such a, doesn't make a huge difference either way. So that's all some order one factor. H100. Cosmology lives in this land between particle physicists who like to make their units easy, and astronomers who, it's not that they like to make their units hard, but they love the fact that their field is like 2,000 years older than everybody else's field, and they like to preserve units that were invented by cavemen, and so. It's unavoidable in cosmology. One of the nice things about cosmology is that it does have this very close connection with astrophysics and with actual things you can observe. So you take the good with the bad and take the bad with the good. And so, H100, the standard way that the Hubble constant was defined. H100 arose here because we were plugging in the value of the Hubble constant today. So the Hubble constant is a very hard thing to measure, and so it has traditionally had a fudge factor put into it that varies with time as the measurements get better and worse. So the traditional way to define it is that it's 100 times this fudge factor H100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Okay, so what this means, a megaparsec is about 3 million light years. And so what this expression says is that if you look at a galaxy that is 3 million light years away, it looks like it's moving away from you at a rate of 100 kilometers per second. And if you look at a galaxy that is 2 times 3 million light years away, it looks like it's moving away from you at 200 kilometers per second. Modulo this fudge factor, which increasingly appears to be about 0.7. Okay, so it actually is, actually, the actual measured Hubble expansion is that as you go out a megaparsec, which is another of these units that you will hear a lot of, it's really not worth your while to know how a megaparsec is defined. It's about 3 million light years. So anyway, H is about 0.7. That's all I wanted to say. So this is about 1/10. This is about 0.7. So what this is saying is that if this fraction here is going to be equal to 0.25, or in any case, whether this particle is or is not the dark matter, it has to be less than or equal to 0.25, right? Because there's certainly no more than 25% of the universe is this relic particle. That means you get you're getting a very stringent constraint on the mass of whatever particle froze out. This equation is basically saying that it can't be more than about 10 or a few tens of electron volts, which is really a very low mass by particle physics standards, right? The lightest, except for the neutrino, the lightest massive particle in the standard model is the electron, which is 500,000 eV. So this bound, just a little back of the envelope calculation, said that any relativistic particle, any massive particle that froze out in the early universe when it was still relativistic has this extremely tight bound on its mass. And so first of all, the two important points to say about this, and then I'll finish for today. There's two very important points to say about this formula. So first of all, with essentially no work, we got this bound. But there is at least one particle in the universe that is of this nature, and that is the neutrino. The neutrino is a particle which we now know to have mass and that froze out at a temperature of 1 MeV. In other words, at a temperature that was much higher than its mass. So it was relativistic when it decoupled at around the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So this bound applies to the neutrino mass. And so for a while, this was actually the best bound in the neutrino mass, that it had to be less than 10-ish EV, or the sum of the three neutrino masses had to be less than a few tens of EV. So now we have better bounds, also from cosmology. So that's the first point. So the second point is why this equation tells you why this model is ruled out as a model of dark matter, and that is, okay. So this particle, according to this equation, this putative dark matter particle has to have a quite low mass. And when it froze out, it was still relativistic. So what happened is, first it was in thermal equilibrium. It was knocking around. It wasn't able to go very far. It was running into things all the time. But then it froze out, and it was essentially moving at the speed of light still. It was relativistic. So it went flying off across the universe. And it continued to fly across the universe like a photon until the Hubble drag slowed it down enough that it became non-relativistic. Okay. So since it is relatively light, it only became non-relativistic relatively late in the evolution of the universe. And during that time, one of the things that you can convince yourself of, this is a general fact about, a good general fact to keep in mind about the behavior of geodesics, massive geodesics, in an FRW spacetime. So remember, we said massless geodesics, a massless particle just keeps on moving at the speed of light past co-moving observers forever. Its energy gets lower and lower, but it just keeps on moving. But a massive particle eventually comes to rest with respect to co-moving observers. So you start it with some high velocity, but eventually it comes to rest. But if you ask how far, what co-moving distance has the massive particle traveled during, but before it comes to rest with respect to co-moving observers, that distance is equal to 1 over, that co-moving distance is equal to the co-moving size of the Hubble horizon at that moment. So in other words, there's M, and then, meanwhile, H is, as the universe is evolving, the Hubble rate is dropping and dropping during the radiation-dominated era. At some moment, M becomes equal to H, and then, roughly speaking, that's the moment that after which this particle becomes non-relativistic and doesn't go much further. But prior to that moment, it has managed to cross roughly the length scale corresponding to H here. So the co-moving length scale corresponding to H is the, oh well, I'm getting a strong feeling that the more that I say, the more confusing this will be. The main thing that I want to say is because this particle is relativistic when it decouples from the thermal bath and goes shoot, and all, so all the dark matter particles suddenly become decoupled and go shooting off across the universe, they end up smoothing out. So we had this initial pattern of fluctuations, this initial random pattern of fluctuations that was going to grow into the structure that we observe today. I was drawing this picture of tiny little fluctuations that as the universe evolved, gradually got the dips gradually got lower, the peaks gradually got higher. But these dips and peaks are primarily this dark matter density that we were talking about. And so what happens here is that if the particles randomly stream over some relatively large distance, they smooth out any dips that are smaller than that distance. They essentially just erase them. So there's a period where the peaks just flow into the dips and they wash out. So if there's some large scale, if there's some long wavelength perturbation, which is much longer than the amount of distance that the particles have a chance to free stream before they become non-relativistic, then those long wavelength perturbations don't get washed out. But these little perturbations do get washed out because everything streams into everything else. And so the prediction of this model is that you shouldn't see any structures, any galaxies or stars or whatever formed. You would predict all sorts of small scale structure corresponding to these small wavelength perturbations. And indeed, you observe this sort of small scale structure when you look out at the structure of the universe today. But in these hot dark, in these hot thermal relic models, because the dark matter particle has an initial period where it freely streams, it washes out this stuff and would have erased that structure. You wouldn't have that structure in the universe today. You would only have these very long wavelength, large scale structures. And that's not what is observed. Okay, so those guys are gone. I'll finish up with dark matter next time. Did any positive information come out of that last explanation? Do you get at least the rough qualitative idea of why this guy is ruled out? So the point is that you see a significant amount of structuring of the matter down to sufficiently small scale. So we'll quantify this more, but the power spectrum, you measure the power spectrum, the amount of clustering of the matter, and the amount of that clustering depends on the scale at which you're looking. For example, if you put a galaxy here, this will be easier to explain. I'll give a little more background later in the week. But you measure the correlation function between different matter. So in other words, if you have a little bit of matter here, it could be that every bit of matter is randomly distributed in the universe, but nevertheless, the random distribution has the property that if I put some matter here, it makes it a little bit more likely to find matter here, and a little bit less likely to find matter here, and a little bit more likely to find matter a little bit further away, and a little bit less likely, or something like that. So the point is there's this extra influence, there's this correlation between if you put one bit of matter at the origin, as a function of distance, as a function of scale, how does it enhance or suppress the probability of structure at some distance away? And so that that is, we can observe that there is enhancement or suppression down to small enough scales that the enhancement or suppression would have been washed out on those small scales if the dark matter had been common. Okay, yeah, I apologize for running over.